We will talk with the author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance this hour, who says too often lawmakers pursue policies based on personal beliefs and not research-based evidence. And we wonder if you can think of any examples of this. I'll bet you can. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, February 1st. Our guest says too many public policies, from sex education to tax reform, are built upon myths and misunderstandings. He says that Republicans and Democrats are guilty of this, and so are we as voters. We welcome your questions and your beliefs at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Schultz, professor in the School of Business at Hamline University, editor of the Journal of Public Affairs Education, and author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Good morning.
Good morning.
So for the purposes of this discussion, how do we define ignorance?
Well, what I define as ignorance is looking at a series of policies that legislators and congressional members, but mostly legislators, repeatedly reenact, even though there is really good evidence that the policies that they're going to adopt are probably going to fail.
So with all the statistics and information that are all over the place, including past failures, why is this happening?
Well, that's part of the book. Part of the book is explaining that. The other part we'll talk about a little bit later is the documentation of some of the most repeated failures. But as I argue in the book, a variety of forces come to bear. Some of them is about money in politics, some of it about partisanship, some of it about ideology, some of it about the fact that in some situations, those people who are making policy, while well-meaning, may be just not equipped to handle the tasks of grasping complex information. I think about the state of Minnesota, where I am, for example, is that we have elections in November, and 2 months later, we ask, in this case, 50 brand new state legislators to now undertake the complex process of doing a two-year budget when they have barely any experience in terms of being in government. And I don't know about you, but, in my first 6 months, let alone the first 6 weeks of my job, I barely knew where the doors were, let alone how to do my job. And so partly it's all that, but in some situations, it is also sort of, willful blindness to the facts, that even when presented with the information, even when presented with studies regarding, and I talk about in my book anywhere from public funding for stadiums to education programs on teenage pregnancy, oftentimes, again, partisanship, party line politics, special interest politics prevent legislators from being able to digest that information and make policy based upon the best evidence at hand.
Yeah, well, and you also say it's not just lawmakers that are doing this. Voters are doing this, too.
Voters are doing it also. And in some sense, we're part of the problem, although that wasn't mainly the focus of my book. But clearly, that when public officials make a series of promises or talk about various ideas, the fact that these are ideas that have been trotted out in the past, and we either don't seem to have the memory or we haven't sort of stayed focused to say, but didn't we try this once in the past? We don't always do our homework in terms of being prepared for being able to criticize or to be able to say, what makes you think it's going to work this time?
Yeah. Well, I know the book is about why this is happening. How big of a problem is this? I mean, why should we be concerned that this happens?
Well, a couple of reasons why we should be concerned. First off, we all know at this point, the public sector government is under enormous financial pressures at this point in order to be able to reduce funding and to reduce spending. And at the same time, we are clearly asking our public officials to be more effective in the programs they they seek to develop and put into place. And so it's a combination of fiscal pressures and a general demand to say that we ought to be doing better than we are, we ought to be getting better results than we are, that leads to part of the problem here. But then additionally, in terms of the scope of the problem, for example, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is sort of the myth of taxes in terms of, you know, how important taxes are in terms of affecting, for example, business location decisions. And we see all across the country, every state in the country has the idea that if we cut taxes or if we provide certain types of business incentives, tax incentives, rather, I should say, to businesses, they will relocate to our state. So we have a 50-state bidding war, and if we go down to the local level, who knows how many cities are doing this, but we have this incredible bidding war that totals in the tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars per year that is being offered to businesses and corporations to try to lure them to move into a state. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of the dollar amounts here. Incredible amounts of money being spent across a whole bunch of different areas on a variety of programs that, again, oftentimes we have evidence. And how do we have that evidence? It's from the best research out there in terms of social science research, scientific research, but more importantly, it's from past experimentation or past efforts by governments to try to do something, and they've enacted this policy or some variation of it in the past, and it's been shown to fail repeatedly, or we have just good evidence, you know, based upon that experimentation or a variety of other sources, that this is just not going to work.
Yeah, you mentioned budget time in Minnesota where you are. It's obviously budget time here in Wisconsin, too, and one of the main highlights of the upcoming budget address from Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, is that he's going to propose an income tax cut. And you know, everybody thinks that sounds good. Is there reason for us to celebrate there? Is that going to be a good thing for the state according to the evidence?
Well, it might be mixed at best. Again, what we generally know, and I have one chart in my book which actually looks at this over time, is that we hear this argument that says that high taxes on individuals or on corporations are a deterrent to job production or a deterrent to the growth in the economy. And one of the bits of research that I did, and most of the book, by the way, is gathering of research from other sources, and so mm-hmm. It's not just me, but one of the charts that I put together is I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is sort of the official source for all types of, you know, economic data, and went back to, I think, literally 1930 and looked at economic growth, unemployment rates, and correlated or connected that with top individual tax rates in the United States and top corporate tax rates, and basically, you know, did a statistical analysis, which is called correlation, and found that there was literally no connection at all between top tax rates and economic growth or job production. And conversely, there seemed to be no correlation with cutting those rates and the economy improving. I mean, we have situations where back in the 1960s, where the U.S. economy was growing at a phenomenal rate compared to today's standards, and the tax rates, we had individual tax rates, you know, way over 50%. We had corporate tax rates up in the 60-70% range. And so there just seems to be no connection between the two. And so in terms of tax rates and economic growth and overall economic performance, and therefore, you know, the initial sort of statement one would make in looking at Governor Walker's proposal to cut individual tax rates is to say that, well, the evidence doesn't seem to suggest that if your goal is it's going to help produce more jobs or to grow the economy, that's necessarily going to be successful. There are far better ways of helping the economy instead of simply cutting taxes.
But one of those ways is not putting public money toward a sports stadium, which we did here in Wisconsin with raising the sales tax to some years ago to build Miller Park for the Brewers. And for that matter, Lambeau Field got some public subsidies to get renovated. That was not going to help economic development.
Not going to help economic development. I want to bracket off to the side and say that if a community wants to put money into a stadium for the argument of saying that it's an important cultural amenity, that's a whole different story entirely, and we could have a different debate on that. But there's just incredibly overwhelming evidence from across the United States over, you know, 30, 40, 50-year period, if not longer, in terms of looking at major league stadiums, minor league stadiums, all professional sports, looking at it in terms of job production, in terms of economic development, in terms of what economists would call opportunity costs. Opportunity cost being, if you put a dollar into one thing, you know, or would you get a better return if you put it somewhere else? And no matter how you looked at it, stadiums are public subsidies for stadiums are an absolute horrible investment for economic development for a community. Now, clearly, people are going to say, well, when you build a stadium, it produces all these jobs. Well, that's true. They do. But at the same time, you could take that same amount of money and put it into something less sexy but more important, such as building schools, fixing highways, bridges, water and sewer systems, things such as infrastructure development, which would also require brick and mortar, that would have much better, longer-term impact on the economy, and so that it would not only produce the jobs during construction, but at the same time have a much better bang for the buck going down the line.
Well, from tax reform to sex education to voter ID, which we will talk about coming up, our guest this hour says many of our public policies are built upon myths and misunderstandings. And he says too many times lawmakers are choosing their beliefs over research when enacting public policies. And we're wondering if you can think of examples of this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. David Schultz is professor in the School of Business at Hamline University, author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Checking the weather forecast for today. It's going to be cold, very cold, mostly sunny. Highs will be in the single digits. We do have a wind chill advisory in effect until noon today. Wind chill factors as low as 25 to 30 degrees below zero expected throughout the morning. With wind chill values this low, exposed skin can suffer frostbite in as little as 30 minutes. So bundle up, put that scarf over your nose, and stay warm. We are talking about American Politics in the Age of Ignorance with our guest, Professor David Schultz, and we're welcoming your questions for him. What do you think of this? Do you think that voters, lawmakers, Republicans, and Democrats are enacting policies that aren't going to fix a problem, or maybe there isn't even a problem to fix? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. David Schultz, you say that one of the myths is that we need some sort of voter ID to address widespread election fraud.
Yes, this seems to be one that's been percolating for several years. I think it started a little bit after Motor Voter was passed, you know, during the Clinton administration, but clearly since, you know, what we all call Florida 2000, you know, during the Bush-Gore race, it's really heated up into where there seems to be this, and this is one of those issues where there is a partisan divide. There seems to be a partisan divide with many Republicans absolutely convinced that there is widespread voter fraud in the United States affecting the outcome of elections. And the reality is, and this is actually a really statistic, by the way, I looked up in the National Weather Service once, that the chances of being struck by lightning are approximately 1 out of 800,000. You have a better chance of being struck by lightning in the United States than you do in terms of showing that voter fraud is a factor that occurs and affects the outcome of an election. I mean, voter fraud is all in-person voter fraud is infinitesimally small. And yet, because of this sort of fear, this sort of political myth across the United States, you know, we've had many states, you know, including Wisconsin, did it too, you know, to enact, you know, legislation requiring some type of showing of an ID at the polls. Again, even though we know the best evidence overwhelming studies say that if fraud occurs anywhere, A, it occurs with absentee voting, and B, if it occurs anywhere, it's not really fraud in terms of, you know, voters willfully trying to impersonate somebody else, but it's mistakes that oftentimes occur either by voters or, more importantly, by election officials letting people vote when they shouldn't vote.
So do we know if the Republicans, as you say, who support these voter ID bills more so than Democrats, are willfully ignoring that evidence and have other motives for wanting to push the policy?
Well, we do. We see stories from across the United States. I think Pennsylvania last year, you occasionally will get some candor where I think when they were passing their voter ID bill afterwards, one of the Republican legislators said something to the effect of, great, this will now make sure that, you know, we hand the election to Mitt Romney, you know. And so, you know, so we occasionally hear phrases like that. We know that they are sort of confronted with, you know, with this information. And one of the arguments that's oftentimes made by people, you know, who say widespread voter fraud occurs is to really make the argument and say, well, how do we know we don't really know how widespread the voter fraud problem is because we don't have photo ID to detect these individuals. And because it's so difficult to catch voter fraud, that's why they get away with it. But there's this real sort of contradiction, you know, in part of the argument that in states, before they enact voter ID, they'll say, well, we don't know how widespread it is. We need voter ID to figure out how widespread it is. Then voter ID is enacted, for example, like in Indiana. And then once it's enacted and there's no indication that there's any more people being detected in terms of committing voter fraud, then the argument will be, well, see that? We deterred the voter fraud from occurring. You can't have the argument both ways. Indiana is also fascinating in the sense that the Indiana case is the one that went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And when the case was being argued, I think it was being argued at the district court level initially in federal district court, the state of Indiana, in defending the voter ID law, acknowledged in its own response to the court and said, we have never had a proven case of voter impersonation at the polls in the entire history of the state. So the state just conceded it. I mean, absolutely conceded it on the record. And so the long-winded answer to your good question is that I think that many of those who are pushing photo ID clearly know that it doesn't exist in terms of widespread fraud, but do it for either partisan or political advantage in the hope that it'll steer elections in the direction they would like to see.
Yeah. And voters who are voting for the Republicans who are pushing for this policy change, they also believe it or not?
They do. They do. When we look at survey research across the United States, that we clearly do have, again, this sort of this partisan divide on this issue here, where far greater percentage of Republicans do believe that voter fraud exists, as opposed to those, you know, who are Democrats and independents who don't subscribe to that. And again, when confronted with the same information, there'll be either sort of the denial, almost like a Kubler-Ross movie. You know, she did a wonderful book once, what, the five stages of dying, you know, and this will be sort of, you know, the denial stage of saying, well, it really must exist out there. And there will always be sort of, you know, what we call the urban legends. You know, someone will talk about and say, well, I heard from somebody who heard from somebody that, you know, a boatload of people or a truckload of people or a bunch of people who didn't look like they were supposed to be voting showed up at some place. And so all of this, you know, another way of describing it is to say that the voter fraud, along with many things I talk about in the book, are sort of at that level of urban legends, things that people talk about or hear about, but when you try to pin them down and say, you know, what's the evidence for it? Where do you come up with support for it? They can't find it. I think I'm going to call it now, instead of urban legends, Facebook legends.
Yeah, there we go. Maybe we'll wait until our next segment to talk about why voters might be also believing myths. But let's take some calls. Linda and Monroe is with us. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Professor Schultz.
Hi.
I think the Republicans have the myth that if you cut taxes on the wealthy, you can get the debt paid. Now, I've read dozens of books that say that the research shows that it's just the opposite. In fact, I'm reading a book right now by Joseph Stiglitz called The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. I believe a person should pay income tax because I've always read that the more income tax you pay, that just means you're making money and you'll eventually get your whatever you're buying, your house or your farm or business. If you don't pay income tax, you'll never get anywhere in life.
Well, so how come Linda believes that, do you think, Professor Schultz, and so many others think, hey, I'm being taxed to death?
Okay, a couple of things. First off, by the way, the Stiglitz book is a very good book. But first off, if we look at sort of the tax rates in the United States right now and compare them to what tax rates were, individual tax rates in the United States, even back to the 1980s, I mean, believe it or not, we're actually much less taxed now than we were, most people in general, you know, than we were 25 or 30 years ago. Compare the United States to what I call our peers around the world. When I say in class, it's other Western European-style democracies, and our tax rates here are somewhere between one-third and one-half less than what they are elsewhere. So in general, we are, as a society, far less taxed than we were before. And we can actually probably do some, you know, some type of really just nice graphical charts and show that, you know, over a 30-year period, you know, part of the reason why our debt has exploded in the United States is because of the dramatically lower tax rates across the board, but especially what we know is at the upper income levels and at the corporate levels, those rates are fantastically lower. If we go back to the 1950s, for example, you know, we're looking at top individual tax rates in the United States for the top income earners at over 90%. We are looking at corporations, you know, that paid far greater percentage of the overall share of taxes in the United States compared to what they do now. And so part of our declining economic performance can be associated with this decrease in the payment of taxes. And with that, the other part of the picture is the failure to sort of invest for the future. And I think almost any listener would understand the simple concept that if you want to make money, if you want to do well in life, you have to invest, you have to sort of plan for the future. And I sometimes say that what we've done is not invest in the future, and we're still living off of the investments of our grandparents.
We will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking about American politics in the age of ignorance. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. And we are welcoming your questions and maybe your examples of this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Friday, February the 1st. Our guest is David Schultz. He is a professor in the School of Business at Hamline University. He is the editor of the Journal of Public Affairs Education and author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance. And before we get back to the phones, Professor Schultz, I wanted to ask you, is one party, political party, guiltier than the other when it comes to basing public policy on bad or little information?
I don't think so. I think right now the Republicans get a lot of the rap for it, you know, because of pushing things such as, you know, voter ID, or because of issues such as, you know, sort of a unidimension approach to taxes. But clearly Democrats are equally as guilty. And sort of two areas where Democrats are equally as guilty, we sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier on. You know, one is many big city mayors across the United States, you know, usually Democrat, like to push, you know, building of sports stadiums or public subsidies for sports stadiums as a key for economic development. And similarly, what we also see is something related to that is spending enormous amounts of money on building, you know, convention centers and convention space across the United States with sort of the similar sort of if we build it, they will come kind of an attitude. And so both parties are equally guilty of acting on sort of what I would call the political myths or acting according to, you know, so partisan party lines in terms of how to approach certain types of issues. And so clearly enough guilt or responsibility can be spread around to both parties, major parties.
BJ on Facebook points to the invasion of Iraq as an example of choosing belief over research. He writes, a majority of Americans believed George W. Bush's insinuations that Saddam Hussein was a party to 9/11. Knowing little of the Middle East, they also failed to consider that as much as Iraqis hated Saddam, many would not welcome an American invasion. Well, what are your thoughts on that, Professor Schultz?
Well, why I don't talk about 9/11 in my book, I mean, there is, I mean, the person who sent in the information is correct in the sense that, you know, leading up to the invasion of Iraq, I mean, the overwhelming intelligence, even post-invasion intelligence, indicated that, in fact, Saddam Hussein wasn't tied into 9/11. And yet, when we did surveys upon surveys in terms of asking people, you know, what do they know about involvement or what do they know about Iraq, I think if I remember correctly, you had high percentages of the American public that said that, okay, you know, Iraq was part of it. And I can't remember now, and maybe somebody can help me out on this. I do think it's a few times the Bush administration played off of that sort of ignorance and made allusions to it or references to that, even though all the official statements, all the official intelligence, and still to this day, that is accurate, is that Saddam Hussein in Iraq really had nothing to do with 9/11. And in fact, you know, the Hussein regime was highly suspicious of al-Qaeda also.
Yeah, and I don't know the exact figures from a survey that was done, but most listeners to NPR did not believe that, but correct, most viewers of Fox News did. Can you talk a little bit about how media plays into this?
Yeah, what's interesting is sort of how the media has transformed again in American politics. If we go back to the early 19th century, you know, the media was essentially, you know, was newspapers, and really when people said, you know, there was the party line, literally there was. You know, communities would have the, you know, the Democratic newspaper, early 19th century, of course it wouldn't have been the Republican Party, it would have been the Whig or something else like that, but newspapers were party lines, and you read one if you wanted to get one party line versus another. But eventually we reached this point to where in the early 20th century, newspapers and eventually radio and television, the golden era sort of being the Walter Cronkite era, where we sort of had, you know, the national newspapers and national media trying to play things down the center, partly to sort of maximize, you know, viewership. But really with the rise of cable and, you know, satellite dishes and so forth like that, we now have, in some sense, reverted back to where the Democrats now have MSNBC, the Republicans have Fox News, and we really sort of reemerged with sort of partisan news. And if you watch those two stations, you get very different perceptions of the world in terms of what facts are being disseminated. I would throw AM radio into that also. And so we've got clearly these very sort of partisan types of approaches. And so people will hear sort of one set of news, one set of facts, and not listen to sort of another side, and therefore walk away being convinced, you know, that, you know, voter fraud's widespread, or stadiums are a great idea for, you know, for financing economic development, or whatever the truth or seems to be being espoused on those stations.
Yeah. John in Burlington, Vermont is with us. Hello, John.
Hi, Joy. Thank you so much for this conversation. This is really, we really do in a lot of ways live in a post-factual world, but I just wanted to kind of push back against this this equivalency that's being drawn between Democrats and Republicans, because, you know, I just don't see it. You know, there may be some local Democratic politicians who like stadiums, but, you know, on issue after issue on the right, we see, you know, examples where belief, no matter, you know, how little they're supported, trump the facts. You know, there's, as far as I know, there's almost no economic evidence for this idea that you can cut your way, you can make spending cuts and cuts to government programs, and that austerity is a valid route to prosperity, for example. But on the right, you hear that constantly. One of the reasons that we're not further along legislatively on the battle for equal rights for gays and lesbians is because there are a lot of people on the right, national politicians, who think that gays and lesbians can change their sexual orientation. There's literally no evidence for that. You know, and you look at climate change, which the scientific consensus agrees is happening, and on the right, people are sticking their fingers in their ears and saying, la, 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 you know, and for there are people who still believe that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago in 6 days. You know, like the idea that, and I just don't see, you know, an equal counterweight on the left. I think that one of our problems in this country is that we try in efforts to be fair and impartial to draw equivalencies where none exist, and I think that that's part of the problem.
All right, John, thanks very much. Lots of examples there. I'm not sure we can go to each one of them in depth, but in general, Professor Schultz?
Let me sort of do it in a general comment here. And one of my favorite quotes from the presidential race was back in 2011 when Governor Huntsman, John Huntsman, was still in the Republican race. And I can't remember. I think it was right after. It was at the Reagan Library. It was right after Michelle Bachmann, you know, representative from my state, made some kind of comment about denying global warming. And his quote was, and I'm just reading it here, "Listen, when you make comments that fly in the face of what 98 out of 100 climate scientists have said, when you call into question the science of evolution, all I'm saying is that in order for the Republican Party to win, we can't run from science." And I quote that because I think it's one of my favorite quotes from the presidential race back then. And I partially agree, you know, with the person who just spoke there, you know, who called in, because, you know, that while I'm willing to say that, you know, both parties, you know, seem to be guilty in terms of their ignorance of the facts, right now there seems to be a greater dominance, at least among some parts of the Republican Party, in terms of, you know, denying evolution, denying global warming, and so forth like that. And so I agree that truth is not halfway in between what two different sides are saying. The truth is something different, but that's slightly different than the argument that I'm making here that says in the book that both sides are guilty in terms of oftentimes ignoring good research and evidence when making policy.
Thank you, John. Dave in Wanakee is with us now. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello. I think that the problem is that our leaders are devious. I don't think the problem is so much that they're ignorant. I think they know exactly what they're doing. When Jack Welch comes out and says that the numbers from the Labor Statistics Board can't be believed, he knows that they are not only believable, he's relied on them his whole career. But right before the election, he says that they're not credible. He's being devious. I don't have to make an argument for the other side. I know that he's being devious.
All right. Well, we touched on this as to whether lawmakers and others were willfully ignoring the evidence. Is that the same as saying devious?
Possibly. Mm-hmm. Possibly. I was going to say depends on how we define devious. But mm-hmm. I think in some situations that people, willfully choose to ignore the facts. For elected officials, it could be because of desire to win re-election, or because by moving on a certain narrative or script in terms of making an argument, it appeals to their base, it helps them with their electability. I think there are lots of reasons, you know, willfulness, deviousness, who knows, a host of different ones might come into play. Again, as I mentioned in the beginning of the book, the partisan pressures to have to adopt a certain party, you know, particular line. You know, look at the debates that have gone on in Congress, you know, for the last couple of months over our various fiscal cliffs here, is that, you know, that at times, you know, Speaker of the House Boehner and Obama have looked like they were getting close on a couple of deals, only to find that there were sort of straight party lines, you know, from their members that prevented them from being able to reach an agreement.
Well, now the one of the big policy issues that's going to be debated in Washington is immigration reform, and you do touch on the myths or misconceptions about immigration in the book.
I do, and one of the myths is that that immigrants are a drain upon the U.S. economy, including, you know, what we need to call undocumented aliens or illegal aliens, whichever term you wish to prefer to use. And there's sort of this image that, you know, we throw in the whole stereotype here, that they're a net drain on the economy, that they are taking jobs away from Americans. And again, in the research that they're, and I point out, this is not my research. I've gathered enormous amounts of sort of research from a variety of different sources, not one, not two, but oftentimes multiple studies. And what we find that is in general that illegal immigrants actually pay more in terms of taxes and contribute more to the economy than they take out. And additionally, the types of jobs that many of these individuals take are jobs that no Americans would be taking. You know, I think in terms of, you know, the classic example of sub-minimum wage illegal immigrants picking strawberries in California, migrant farmers, migrant workers in Minnesota, perhaps in Wisconsin too. And so it's this incredible myth about them being a drain on the economy. And it's very much related to sort of another myth, which I could talk about here, which is sort of the myth of welfare migration.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a big issue back in the 90s when welfare reform was passed. But it's the idea that somehow that individuals who are poor, who are on public assistance, are omniscient, that they can gather 50 state information regarding what the level of welfare benefits are across the United States, make a rational calculation of which state has the highest level of benefits, and then have the resources and wherewithal to move to that state solely for the purpose of collecting, you know, higher welfare benefits. And so many states are worried about being welfare magnets and therefore slash their benefits. And I remember once when I was in graduate school many years ago, the state demographer, you know, when we were talking about this, said, well, one of the great myths about welfare migration is the fact that he said that poor people are generally too poor to migrate.
Yeah.
But in general, again, we have overwhelming studies from across the United States done by state governments, including and by a lot of groups, pointing out that that's just not the case. Welfare migration as a significant factor affecting or being a drain on the economy just doesn't occur.
We're talking about myths and misconceptions when it comes to issues like welfare reform and immigration reform, from voter ID to tax reform to sex education. Why do so many lawmakers choose belief over research? Why are we basing public policies on beliefs and not the research-based evidence behind these issues? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Schultz. He is author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be a sunny, very cold day today. Highs only in the single digits. We'll have wind chill factors well below zero this morning, anywhere between 25 and 30 below zero. Coming up, it's our week in review. We will hear from two guests from different political viewpoints about all the top news stories of the week, including the pitches for immigration reform and the hearing on gun control. Right now we are talking about a lot of those issues and how they become public policy, even though the research says otherwise, with a guest, David Schultz, who is the author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance. He is also a professor in the School of Business at Hamline University. Our next caller is Ron in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Your guest just touched on a few points. One of them, I'm reminded of what Noam Chomsky once said, and I'm paraphrasing that, The more you can make people fear welfare mothers and illegal aliens and so forth, the more you can control them. And I feel that that's something that the Republican Party has done for a very long time. I mean, back when McCain was running against Obama the first time, it was illegal aliens. We need a fence. We need this. George Bush put the fear in about Iran and that they were the ones for 9/11 and so forth. And you know, even this last election, you know, it's everybody that's on welfare is draining the economy when only 2% of our economy is basically going out to welfare, and the rest is going out towards Social Security and a lot of other things. That so it's just a matter of fear that they are trying to instill and trying to get their vote.
Professor Schultz?
You know, I teach in a school of business where my colleagues teach marketing, and I asked one of my colleagues once, I said, what's the essence of marketing? And he said, everything you need to know about marketing comes down to, what he says, FUD, fear, uncertainty, and dread. He said, most commercials try to sell products by doing that. And if we think of oftentimes politicians as also marketers, you know, trying to sell an idea or try to sell a concept in terms of getting them reelected, oftentimes it clearly is the case that, you know, fear, uncertainty, dread are similar types of motives that are appealed to. And so I think in many situations we look for scapegoats. You know, during the 1990s, again, you know, when we were pushing for welfare reform, you know, again, the American public was asked, you know, what percentage do you think of our deficit, you know, or of our expenses go to welfare? And I can't remember what it was, but it was an enormously high percentage, where in fact, you know, aid for families with dependent children and welfare programs was like 0.5%. Ask the American public now how much money is spent on things such as foreign aid, and they'll say numbers that far outstrip what they are. And the whole point being here is that in many situations, you know, politicians will look for scapegoats. Will point to people and say, you know, as a caller called in and said, it's this population or this problem or this issue that is the problem. And part of what I try to talk about in my book is that in the way that there's probably no single silver bullet to solve any of our social problems in the United States, there's probably no single boogeyman, if I can use that phrase, you know, for a phrase I use a lot of us when we were growing up, you know, that cause all of our problems. And so we sometimes look for simplistic solutions or simplistic problems when in fact it's much more complex. And that becomes, I think, part of why, you know, we have these political myths, because we do think there are oftentimes simple answers when the fact is there are not.
Yeah, you know, you didn't specifically deal with the issue of gun laws or gun control in your book, but with this debate going on right now, you will hear guests on both sides or advocates on both sides saying, you know, look at this study, it says this, look at that study, it says that. There's lots of evidence out there, but it depends who's reading it, I think, Professor Schultz.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's part, you know, I always tell people that, you know, the first thing that I do whenever I see studies is I look to the footnotes right off the bat. And I know that sounds kind of geeky or nerdy, but it's to always look at, you know, who are they citing? What's their methodology? How are they doing their study? Because that I want to know first, you know. And going back to a comment I made earlier, you know, how do a lot of the myths get perpetrated now? You know, I think about the amount of stuff that I see on Facebook from my friends, and you probably see the same thing. They'll claim all kinds of stuff like that or reference all kinds of stuff, and then I'll look at it, and most of the stuff probably isn't worth sort of the time that it took to cue the stuff in on the computer or something. And so, yeah, we're going to see a lot of stuff in terms of on the gun control debate back and forth, and it's going to be important when we see that to actually look at, again, who's sponsoring the studies, what are the studies really saying. Oftentimes people will misconstrue or stretch what the arguments are in a study or something like that. So this is the point of where I expect legislators to do their job. I don't expect all of us, you know, we work, we take care of families, we're not specialists in any of this stuff, for us to be able to do all this digestion in terms of sorting out. But one of the most primary tasks of legislators and of members of Congress is the fact-finding authority, the ability and the requirement that they're supposed to gather information, digest it, and use that to make good public policy. And that's the failure. That's the failure that my book is trying to identify, is to say that if making law is a decision-making process, we've got to figure out ways to improve it. And the gun control debate, or the gun control or gun regulation debate, whatever you want to call it, is going to be a really interesting test and example to see how good of a job we do in terms of gathering information to reach some solutions.
Well, this has been eye-opening, and I Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
David Schultz is the author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.